I mean, there's people in front of me destroying Waymos, there's niggas behind me destroying Waymos. There's thousands of people out here disgusted with the Trump administration and how the federal government is handling migration. People are out here with hammers, baseball bats, whatever weapon they can find. It's dark.
All right. I am sure we were all busy at the No Kings protest this weekend, but I am joined with two kings today. The King of Brooklyn, Sean KB, and of Los Angeles, Victor Artolo, author of Los Angeles or the End of Assimilation from illwill.com, an excellent essay about the last week of struggle in Los Angeles with very good analysis of the material questions behind it. So very happy to talk to you about this excellent essay. How are you doing today, Victor? How has your weekend been?
I'm doing great. You know, I'm in the kind of week-long point of the ongoing struggle. You get kind of a manic high, you know. So it's good to talk to someone from out of LA to get any frame of reference for how this is all being perceived and kind of what the sense is outside of the city.
That's summer feeling.
I went bowling today, man. I don't know if you've been bowling recently, but, you know, it's still the same. It's good.
Yeah, no, I've been spending the last 5 days going to Home Depot at 6 a.m. not bowling in my future.
What's the scene like at the 6 a.m. Home Depot? I guess it's just an ice watch shift, or is ice there staged?
It's an ice watch shift. So, yeah, I mean, just this whole kind of thing kicked off last Friday because of a couple of initial raids, right? So there was the probably less reported on raid of that Home Depot, and then basically right smack in the center of LA, you know, Westlake. This is a kind of long tongue, working class Latina neighborhood, really with a huge influx of people coming in from Central America in the 80s. And so that definitely felt like a real provocation. And the other one was kind of the clothing textile company down in downtown. And so, yeah, there's basically, you know, like any Home Depot, there's kind of a informal economy of day laborers, vendors that support them. And, you know, people got to work at the end of the day. So people are still out there. And we are trying to form some kind of, yeah, these kinds of community centers of defense that were kind of called for at the end of the piece.
And it seems like, you know, there's been some reporting that after the riots last week, they were unable to carry out a lot of the sweeps they wanted to do, but it sounds like they were able to do some sweeps in Los Angeles County this week. Does it seem like these sort of shifts and like rapid responses have been curtailing it to a minimum, or does it seem like just a constant cat and mouse?
Yeah, I mean, I feel it's definitely kind of a sprawling operation at this point. I think they were seeing the real concentrated kind of struggle on the ground initially that Friday, next Saturday in Paramount, and have kind of devolved down to what seem to be these random snatch and grabs. You know, you'll see a video of a fruit vendor in one part of town, and then they'll go to a SWAT meet, you know, 30 miles away. And, you know, LA's is kind of a sprawling kind of working class suburbs really makes up the brunt of it. And these are majority, you know, 60% to 80% Latino. So there's kind of no dearth of targets that ICE can go after.
Well, so where would you want to start with the article? Because it begins with this analysis, you know, this question of assimilation that you refer to in the title is not, you know, the assimilation of the Latino immigrant working class into the American culture, but the assimilation of the working class into capital in the state, which is a really interesting way of framing this whole moment of accelerating ICE raids. Would you want to start with like sort of the intro analysis or just go through what happened this over this past week in LA?
You know, yeah, I think we can kind of start broader and then get down to kind of nitty gritty, because I think there's kind of some interesting tactical observations that could be useful to other cities. But I do think, you know, Sean, you mentioned earlier, right, that this specter of the LA riots is kind of a persistent feature of that. You know, every 30 years or so, you get these kind of sustained or inner city riots in LA. But I do think, you know, there's something that is particularly being revealed about this moment, especially with regards to kind of how historically, you know, the immigrant struggle has been kind of based around respectability, around kind of a demand for legalization. And I think, you know, this goes back 20 years where essentially those prospects have been more and more of a dwindling kind of future. And I think what you're seeing kind of today and in the past week is really, you know, both the working class immigrants themselves, but also really, you know, their children at the end of the day. Like I'm a child of immigrants that came in the 80s. Kind of recognizing that, you know, this stream of kind of following the path of the Irish, of the Eastern Europeans, of the Italians, maybe isn't kind of basically in the cards. And so this kind of sense of a new future that's driving the particular kind of outlook and the strategies and the tactics on the ground is looking a lot more like, you know, Black Lives Matter and really the kind of mass marches of the mid-2000s.
Yeah, I'd like to read just a couple paragraphs from the intro because you put it really well. I think it'd be better just to read it than to summarize it. You write, "While others may have forgotten the lessons of the George Floyd uprising, Trump and his coterie surely have not. The 2020 rebellion stands as the primal scene of humiliation and impotency, one which led to the demise of his reelection efforts. Although the National Guard ultimately restored order in 23 states in 2020, the Trump hardliners never had their bloodlust quenched. Thwarted by career bureaucrats like General Mark Milley and Attorney General William Barr, who declined to send in the army. Seen in this light, the present reconfiguration of the American disciplinary executive apparatus shows itself to be a rather clear effort to avoid such a moment. Appropriate to our contemporary era, a deeply consequential restructuring reveals itself to be a petty project of a scorned racket. As the product of the war on terror, the Department of Homeland Security, and with it, ICE, has always been a steadfast bulwark of a deeper reactionary project." So what's this point that you're trying to make about the state and the disciplining of labor, what these accelerating ICE raids reveal in this moment?
Yeah, so I think, you know, like any kind of conflagration, like any kind of real conjuncture, that's defined by overdetermination. So I think there's kind of varying prospects and projects at play. You know, I think there's the longer arc of immigration and deportation strategy that's now finding maybe a new kind of mode of operating within the country itself. But I also think kind of concurrent to that and also stretching back to kind of the development of this war on terror project and such that kind of happened at the same time as this kind of a falling of the immigration kind of reform debate is you're seeing like kind of this acceleration of essentially these disciplinary apparatuses, the FBI, ICE, DHS, kind of more and more essentially directly under the purview of less kind of administrative limits or kind of essentially being law enforcement and more just kind of being the personal kind of force for the executive at this point. You know, I'll say Trump, but I do think Trump himself is kind of a contradiction in terms. I think there are elements within the administration like Mueller and such who have a pretty hardline approach. And I think there are others who kind of are interested in maybe maintaining some form of stability or at least some interest for capital at this moment.
Yeah, and we're seeing that play out with Trump walking back raids, at least at farms. And there were some raids in Oxnard, California that might have prompted this, but also hotels and restaurants. So some have celebrated this as a victory of like, you know, the capitalists calling in Trump saying, hey, chill out with getting rid of all of our workers, because like over 40% of farm workers in the country are undocumented immigrants. But I don't know what this means for like the Home Depot type sweeps or sweeps at places like Ambience Apparel, a clothing factory. It seems like maybe some industries are still going to be prone to these sort of out of the blue immigration raids, if not, you know, continuing at courthouses and schools and homeless shelters like we've seen in the New York suburbs.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is where it's important to kind of start drawing like an actual really kind of variated kind of sense of who exactly this immigrant working class that we're talking about is, right? I think kind of the product of the kind of strategy of respectability and assimilation has been to really center workers like the agricultural workers, like hospitality workers, where the kind of their labor is kind of this stable, so kind of a critical said source of stability and kind of you know, needs for capital. But there is, you know, a wide swath of immigrants, especially within, you know, the urban core that essentially function off of really kind of informal sources of labor, right? They're vendors, they're day laborers, maybe they have intermittent wage labor. And so even if maybe perhaps there's the rolling back of these sweeps in the kind of agricultural sector, you know, I don't see necessarily any kind of objective limit to right picking up a fruit vendor off the street or kind of a group of day laborers at the end of the day. I think, you know, in some sense, this is, you know, some kind of implicit or kind of hope for cope, right? That somehow this can be stopped because it's not in the interest of capital, this kind of project of mass deportation, of this, of reaching this target of a million deportations a year is not going to happen. But I think you really have to look closely at maybe how spatially this might kind of play out. And, you know, who might be hip artists, who might be exempted.
Where I just to jump in here, where it occurs to me that we're in a very interesting place, you know, when Andy brings up the pushback that the Trump administration has gotten from various sectors of capital. We're in an interesting place because so much seems new about Trump 2.0, where there was a promise that we would like cross some sort of Rubicon. Of course, very fearful for Democrats. This is fascism, you know. Very fearful for anybody who believes in, you know, workers' rights and migrant rights. But we see already, not just with the immigration situation, but also in the Middle East, that reality is reimposing itself on the project, whether the project is reordering the Middle East, it's running up against Iranian ballistic missiles, or whether it's like a complete overhaul of the immigration system, empowering ICE to like really get like American Gestapo on stuff. This meets like the actual constraints of the executive. What do you think right now about this? Like, what is new about this new immigration response by the state? And what is redolent of these battles that we've been having in this country since, I guess, the 1970s, 80s, 90s? What's new and what's old?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, there's been kind of this long-term project in immigration strategy that has essentially ramped up deportations going back to Obama, right? There's this reframe of the Obama as a deporter-in-chief that I think has a lot of truth to it. And just like how we have to kind of get a little more serious about thinking about the kind of concrete differentiation of you know, the immigrant working class, we need to start thinking about what different kind of modes of immigration enforcement and deportation kind of really reveal. I think one of the things I mentioned in the piece is that Obama was really kind of innovative in making permanent kind of barriers to reentry a permanent factor, right? I think prior to that, there was kind of a more of a flexibility in terms of allowing immigrants to return because many were leaving the kind of these voluntary kind of returns back to their home country, which just meant, you know, they can, you know, given the need for income maybe, or given the lack of work and so on, they could just come back to the country, work again, maybe go back to their home country. But with the kind of early, you know, first term Obama strategy of these formal removals, essentially, the stakes are just increased so much more for returns, right? Like the kind of there's these increasing barriers to entry, and I think kind of a few kind of categories to think about, right, are kind of enforcement at the border and enforcement within the interior. I think you kind of do see, and you know, a lot of the work that I'm doing and then the piece is a bit speculative, and I think there's a lot more work that has to be done. But I do think you do see kind of a general trend towards the increase of internal apprehensions that definitely spike up when there are labor market instabilities. But the border, right, the border has always been this place that has increasingly been militarized. You know, it's no surprise that we see border patrol out in the interior of the country. You know, for the past 15 years, they've essentially been giving the mission of fortifying the country, of being told that, you know, it's your job to keep these migrants from coming in. And, you know, a lot of these guys feel like they haven't been given the free rein to do their job. And so what seems to be happening now really is taking that kind of hardline militarized approach to the border and really putting it into the core of cities. And I think this is kind of coalescing a bit with what I mentioned about kind of this attempt to show a real kind of executive disciplinary violent force on the part of Trump.
And so how did this all really kick off? I mean, you mentioned a little bit about the early sweeps, but it seems like two incidents I hear cited a lot was the arrest of a SEIU leader after they had done a rapid response at Ambience and Peril, I think. And then also someone getting hit by a car trying to blockade a vehicle. Maybe give us just a little bit of a timeline of what happened last weekend.
Yeah, totally. I remember back in, mid to late May, we were already seeing these kinds of confrontations happening, where these kinds of really public internal apprehensions and operation device, right? You were seeing these public kind of confrontations in Chicago and Minneapolis and San Diego just in the week or two before what kicked off in LA happened. And so I think there was already kind of this presentiment that, when ICE is coming in, they're expecting this kind of response. They're expecting this to be, essentially kind of igniting this really direct public conflict. And so, this really kicked off in LA last Friday, June 4th, 5th. It's, again, days are blending in. But it started with, seemed to be both this combination of essentially going after these day laborers and these really kind of informal labor markets, but also going after a core set of workers, right? So the textile industry in Los Angeles is huge and it really is dependent on Latino immigrants. And so we were seeing this, interesting dichotomy. And I think the former is really kind of won out at the end of the day, but the latter was really kind of a sparking point. So yeah, they raided two locations of Ambience Apparel. They raided a storefront just a few, just a mile out of the core of downtown in the Fashion District. And then the warehouse, which is probably where they took more people at the end of the day, which is in this kind of industrial logistical zone across the LA River. And both of those responses, I think you were seeing, again, these kinds of really public confrontations that you were seeing in Chicago and San Diego and such. The response is, who comes to these things is really interesting. You get family members who just run the factory gates or the warehouse gates when they hear that something is going down. You get a lot of standerbys and passerbys who are just kind of around because these are in dense neighborhoods. But you also get, this kind of activist core. It is interesting that, the SEIU president essentially kind of put himself on the front line at that warehouse.
Yeah. So how did that initial response happen? Was there rapid response network that included the SEIU that got them down there so quickly?
Exactly care how David Wirth, the SEIU president, ended up there. But there's been a pretty well-established kind of network of rapid response that has spread it up, with the first couple of months of the Trump term, right? I think people were hearing this rhetoric about mass deportations and this intent to go into sanctuary cities. And there was a lot of infrastructure that was put in place by immigrant activists, group chats, and so on, many, many group chats, explosion of group chats, essentially. And so there was kind of this infrastructure where anytime there was an ICE sighting, there was an immediate kind of, spreading of that information among a pretty diverse array of people. LA has like a very dense organization of immigrant activists, right? You have the kind of informal activists of like Unión del Barrio, which come out of the Chicano rights movement, kind of based out of East LA, and you have been recently named in some of these letters from Josh Hawley. But the whole labor movement is based and gets its strength out of this 90s, early 2000s movement that's kind of spearheaded by immigrants, right? Janitors for Justice and so on. So like the question of immigrant labor is kind of cuts across both these really formal organizations and these really kind of activist-y informal organizations too.
I recall back when I was a younger man, the Day Without an Immigrant, right? The 2004 basically general strike, I think was centered in Southern California. Is that right?
That was, I think, in 2006, right around the debate about comprehensive immigration reform under Bush. Essentially a general strike of storefronts, of workers, and also these massive high school walkouts. And I think that was kind of both the climax of this turn towards respectability and this yearning for assimilation. And maybe also kind of the last time we'll maybe see that, right? You're going to see a lot more stuff like what's been happening in LA for the past week.
Yeah, I mean, so this is not really a Day Without an Immigrant type march or general strike. It's not, well, not citywide either, but like concentrated demonstrations turning into riotous confrontations with the police or with ICE. And it seems like a lot of it's centered around the federal detention center. That was maybe kicked off because of David Huerta's arrest, or was that because just every activist knew to sort of go there because that's where ICE was detaining people?
I think it's definitely both, right? So, you know, there is this really militant core of both politically formal affiliated, you know, working class Latino youth, and just, you know, basically, right, the kids and nephews and nieces of the people that are being taken. And so, yeah, that happened within hours, right? So this warehouse in downtown was raided around 10, 11 a.m. And the warehouse itself was cleared out pretty quickly. I mentioned in the piece, right, when people kind of responded to that raid, there was a real kind of trepidation around, you know, what are we doing here? Are we trying to give people their rights, or are people trying to kind of stop the actual, you know, apprehension and detention of these immigrants? And so the kind of spatial particularity of the warehouse, on a place a lot of people are familiar with, there's a lot of exits, really made that kind of, you know, basically go forward pretty quickly. But in downtown, at the storefront location, the FBI were, you know, part of this operating force. They deployed flash gangs, tear gas. You know, it got really confrontational really quickly. You know, this is a very tidy street. And there was, you know, upwards of 50 to 100 people. And just getting the actual agents at the end of the day was a real struggle for this like task force. And then, yeah, people, you know, I think both on the one hand were buoyed by and driven to action by the arrest of David Huerta. But also, again, there is this kind of already existing informal and more radical activist-y influx into the movement that's been kind of active for a while. You know, it's interesting, at the detention center, there were actually kind of two things called. So there was the SEIU rally around 4:30. It was, you know, demanding the release of David Huerta. At the same time, there was also calls out by Union del Barrio, this kind of coalition force of a lot of activist groups and kind of that comes out of a Chicano movement that was, and they had their own kind of different kind of interesting spatiality. So the David Huerta one was just right outside the federal courthouse. It was about doing a sound truck rally and so on. And the UDB one was right outside the garage of the actual detention facility, right? So this is where vans would come in and out. And at the detention center, you had a crowd of about 1,000 people that it eventually gave way to a march around the building. And about, you know, half the group ended up staying on this march. But as we passed, as people passed this garage, you know, the immediate goal, again, of kind of putting some material kind of movements against these detentions and apprehensions was kind of clear to everyone. There were kind of these frontliners there who really kind of quickly started doing these kind of raucous actions against the agents who were kind of just outside or just behind the garage doors. People, you know, were staying at supporting them. Verbally, material ways, and so on. And so I think, you know, that moment, you know, there could have been that moment where SEIU does this rally. They stick to their guns about remaining within kind of this call for legal norms and legal rights and so on. But that just wasn't really clearly the intent and goal of a vast, you know, or at least a substantial portion of people who were driven that day.
So, Victor, I find your dates to be really good, because it is quite difficult out here on the East Coast to get a sense of all that's going on. And so not just what you've told us today, but also your piece in Ill Will, I think, has been really powerful and good for us. I wonder where the next place we could go is, because I had an experience in the shanty recently. I know everyone loves my shanty stories, but the apprentice, Jesus, who I work with, very nice kid, very, very smart, good kid, good worker. He asked me what I thought about the shit going on in LA. And in my way, I'm actually more interested in what he had to say, but he was just like, bro, it's just crazy. You know, he just thought it was like, he just saw the images happening. And he said, oh, that's crazy. And, you know, being on the East Coast, I guess what I had to say to him was that, it seems to me in a national political sense, and I'm not close like you, so I'm not, it's not clear to me except by reading your stuff, like what the proletarian, the class dynamics are, the self-organizational dynamics are. But what is clear to me on the East Coast, or at least the way I attempted to answer his question, was to look at it in terms of this Trump administration, which is seems to be just kind of flailing from place to place, flailing even to get its deportation regime off the ground, finding LA a very conducive place to pick a fight, and the activists in LA ready to, for obvious reasons, have this fight with ICE. And more broadly in a political, capitalist political sense, Gavin Newsom being a great foil for MAGA, not to mention your mayor, right, who caught a lot of shit for her response to the Palisades fire. It seems to me like on top of what's happening on the ground, which is all very real, real activists with real stakes on the ground, you also have the national political dynamic of it, which feels to me somewhat opportunistic, because I feel like they had to know, ICE had to know, Trump, Steve Miller had to know that going into LA, guns blazing like this was going to cause a reaction. And I think they were maybe banking on that. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in the piece, I kind of put forward the prospect of, you know, this media regime, we're entering a new era of really this kind of disciplinary apparatus being really centered in on just everyday Americans, immigrants, and so on. And so I think on the one hand, right, they are coming in, they're looking to pick a fight, they want to set an example. Maybe they want to flex a bit of muscle, right? So they've been doing all these purges at the FBI and, you know, other kinds of more kind of stalwart federal law enforcement. So maybe they're looking to see kind of, you know, how far they could go, how far their kind of chain of command really extends. You know, you see this too with the HEXF, you know, willing and open to just sending in the Marines for basically what amounts to, you know, a couple of rowdy protests and skirmishes downtown. But at the end of the day, right, LAPD is totally equipped to deal with. And at the end of the day, they're also doing most of the enforcement, right? At this point, direct confrontations with the National Guard of Marines are not kind of the norm. It's just LAPD.
Well, you mentioned in the piece that LA is a sanctuary city, and maybe it's more of a sanctuary city now than New York is, because Eric Adams is working hand in glove with the Trump administration. I wonder if the more military deployment aspect of it is both to try to like raise the stakes of the confrontation to the point to make it clear that, like, well, we actually are going to war with the working class. And if you try to stop this, then the military will treat you like an enemy combatant. Or if it's because there's a sense that LA police might be a little bit more hands off.
Yeah, I mean, from direct experience, the police are definitely not hands off, right? They've sent out the horse cops. You know, they're loving this action.
But even insisting with raids as opposed to just policing protests.
So, you get an interesting dynamic with the LAPD of the raids, because now it's a little bit more haphazard that they're not really needing the LAPD to be on site. You know, the LAPD is really, was there initially to essentially hold the line against the demonstrators, against activists, and both just kind of, you know, keeping them away from certain exits and stuff, but also, you know, every you know, there's a big culture of activists in LA that love to yell at the cops and maybe not think about what should actually strategically be done, and so there's also that aspect to it. But at the same time that there were these No Kings protests and you know, these raids, you know, there was this military parade, which, you know, was kind of anticipated to be this kind of North Korean style show of force. It didn't quite end up that way.
Quite the opposite, right? It was widely panned. Andy, have you seen clips from this thing? I saw a couple and I thought, oh my God, this is like a Trump losing the mandate of heaven, or like the hyper normalization of the American empire. Like, what did you think?
That did not look very cool.
We couldn't pull it off.
I mean, especially considering how humiliating Trump's position in Israel going to war with Iran is in the middle of the negotiations. Obviously, we know that Trump was just, that was part of the strategy, was to have Iran let their guard down. But that's not how he's framing it. He's not coming out and saying this was all a trick to, like, find out who the negotiators are and kill them. He's making it seem like Israel jumped the gun. But yeah, for him to have a military parade in the midst of a U.S. proxy going to war with Iran looks really bad, as it also looks really bad for them to appear to need to send out the military to do immigration sweeps that he also has to roll back on some level during the week. I mean, there is a sense, as heightened as the contradictions are becoming with the use of state forests to discipline labor and to expand this war that's clearly for Israel in the Middle East, as bad as that all looks, I think that the military parade during that really is a sort of sign of Trump's and America's impotence in all of this, in a way that's not exactly heartening either.
No, it's not like an impotence that the Los Angeles riots are going to be able to turn into some sort of revolutionary situation. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm too cynical. What do you think, Victor? Is like Trump's failure to deal with things in the Middle East and failure to put on the Coinbase Lockheed Martin military parade from, channeling North Korea, is that indicative of like potential, or is it just sad to see this stupid empire die so stupidly?
Yeah, great question. I mean, our troops can't even march, I guess, at the end of the day.
I guess.
But, you know, I think, you know, this and everything right that's going on right now is there's this kind of big, beautiful bill. And part of that big, beautiful bill is really expanding DHS and ICE. And, you know, I think maybe, you know, in these essentially these experiences of urban warfare, you know, we might see like, you know, a new core of really the military apparatus being kind of essentially deputized with DHS, with ICE. You know, maybe we should consider them, the FBI, this purged FBI, this kind of stalwart reactionary DHS, as also being, you know, the last kind of obstacle and the last wall to some real kind of revolutionary kind of movement and momentum.
Don't we all get the sense, or at least this is the sense I get, I'll ask you guys if you feel the same way, that this is like an impasse, that the state has reached an impasse, politics has reached an impasse, that like the Trump presidency in a world historical sense is like some sort of shitty Hail Mary, like some dumb like button hook, like triple fucking like the halfback throws it to the running back, who throws it to the fucking fullback, who throws it to the quarterback, who tries to throw it into the end zone. It's like a Hail Mary pass attempt to try to like break through what has been a long impasse, especially on immigration, right? Because the last time we had comprehensive immigration reform was what, amnesty under Ronald Reagan in 1983. But since then, like, maybe the reason why ICE is, you know, and the military and the Marines, why it's taking this spectacular form that it's taking, is because you can't do it the normal way, right? Like migrant labor is too integrated into the society and the economy to really be able to do this politically. So you have to have some sort of spectacular thing. I don't know. What do you think, Victor?
Yeah, I mean, I think, at least here in LA, there's this kind of the widespread sense that, you know, the shit base is collapsing, you know. You see these Minneapolis senators be murdered in the morning. You get the shooting at, you know, Salt Lake City in the evening. These raids kind of have no end in sight. You know, I talk to people at the Home Depot and they're like, yeah, well, you know, the army is just going to be around for 30, 60 days, I guess. And so, you know, is this I do think there's an element of, you know, there is this kind of holding pattern, right, to the American state and to capitalize as a whole, where, you know, the last kind of exit was maybe this green transition, this kind of positive reintegration of this, you know, mass industrial working class into these new technologies. And because of various kind of ideological reasons, that's just off the table. And so what do you have is just continued kind of disciplining of surplus populations of an American state that really has no need to have a functioning CDC or a functioning welfare system, right? You know, if you don't need these kind of healthy, stable working class, you know, at the end of the day, you can have your DHS and your ICE and your FBI. And that runs well, you know, they do their job and they have a pretty clear goal and a clear directive.
Part of the piece that's really interesting is that there's this concept of the proletariat being, whether they're documented or not, being rendered surplus population who can be detained or put into prison or deported. And it's like this sort of state fantasy that you can just round up and get rid of the proletariat to the extent that they're unruly in any way. Obviously, we understand as Marxists that the proletariat is what makes the economy work. And so this is something that they're always going to be running up against, no matter how popular mass deportations are. Obviously, they polled very well in the last election. But then when people start to see the chaos that it unleashes, and obviously, if it went to its full extent, that chaos would be deeply economic as well. You know, like food prices would shoot way up if you deported 1 million people, not to mention prices and everything else. It starts to feel like they've given themselves like a central task, which is impossible. And that central task is just to manage the proletariat as an entirely policed and imprisoned population.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I think maybe we'll start seeing the impacts of some of those real kind of material political limits. Maybe we'll see DHS kind of step away from these Oxnard, Central Valley kind of agricultural sector. But, you know, I don't think there's any limits, I mentioned earlier, right, to DHS rounding up street vendors and day laborers, right, or unemployed people, just anyone out in public.
So
I wonder on the politics of this, one of the splits, because there are tremendous splits within the political movement that birthed this new deportation push, which is MAGA, Make America Great Again. One of the splits seems to be about people who feel as though they were sold Mott and Bailey. Like there are some people who I've seen say, like, well, we were supposed to just get rid of the train Aragua. We were supposed to get rid of the hardened criminals. We were supposed to get rid of the rapists. Remember, Trump comes down his golden escalator and talks about some of them are rapists. And they're like offended that, oh, these are hardworking, you know, Mexican and Guatemalan people. I didn't sign up for this. This is not what I voted for. And then you have like the sort of Steve Miller, maybe more like psychotic, xenophobic, middle class part of MAGA, which is like, this is absolutely what we voted for. We voted to like deport grandmas, separate families, like get completely violent and destructive and destroy lives. Like that's what we want. And I don't think that there's a way for us to like intervene within the MAGA movement, but I think it's an interesting distinction. And I wonder if we think maybe it maps along class lines, because I know here in New York, like certainly even in the unionized building trades, there's so much overlap between like first and second generation immigrants and like native born immigrants that I could see like most working class people, at least I know, even ones that voted for Trump, would be like, why are you pulling these people out of like the factories? These are good, like hardworking Christian people. Why would you do this? What do you guys think about that division?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yeah, you're kind of referencing a step that I think was made a lot of hay about, which is, you know, there are these citizen Latino children of immigrants who, you know, through various kind of reactionary deformations, or like, yeah, let's get rid of these criminals, let's get rid of these gang members. But you know, I think there was a poll just, you know, after this LA stuff about, you know, where the kind of support for mass deportation stands, and it's still a solid 40%. You know, 40% of the country is seeing what's happening in LA, and you know, is saying this is good, let's keep it going. And so, you know, I'm a little more pessimistic about this imagined kind of or this perceived potential split. I think there's a really deeply reactionary core of this country that is kind of hard to wrap your head around, right? If you're asking 40% of the country, do you want to essentially, you know, do ethnic cleansing, you know, a million deportations a year? Is this something that we should do? And then they're saying yes. Yeah, I don't know what we do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing to do but fight. And it's interesting to see the situation come about, not because of some, you know, like the George Floyd uprising was sparked by this viral video of a very normal occurrence that was very resonant as a normal occurrence. The uprising in L.A. was responding to a new style of sweep that was going on, but it was also an extension of things that were going on all over the country. Like there was similar kind of unrest in like the New York suburbs and a couple places in Long Island where people ran ICE out of town. There's similar cases in Austin and Minneapolis. It's really happening all over the country. And I want to mention one story that happened in Newark at the Newark ICE facility. This is from a story from the Times called "Inside the Tumult That Led Four Men to Escape from a Migrant Facility" by Tracy Tully, Lewis Ferry Sadumi, and Raul Vilches. So this is a facility built by the GEO Group, which I think has built a lot of these private detention facilities that were lacking in food for like the large number of detainees, lacking AC during very hot days, too hot water for showers. The cafeteria was being used to accommodate migrants who had been moved out to other parts of the facility to address the crowding, which disrupted the delivery of meals that were already too small portions. And so about 4:30 p.m. Last Thursday, several dozen men in Unit 5 on the upper floor of the jailhouse had grown frustrated after returning Thursday afternoon from a first floor cafeteria where they said they had been given slices of bread in place of a meal. They began covering security cameras and smashing at walls and windows. Two security guards stationed in the unit retreated, and some of the detainees pushed doors closed. The men who escaped had punched a hole through an exterior wall of the jail. That was the Senator Andy Kim described as crude, essentially just drywall with some mesh inside. And they were able to climb down with bed sheets, like in classic jailbreak style, and then climb up a fence and escape the facility. And they're still looking for these people. So this is a situation where a more competently built prison, a more competently run prison, would have probably prevented this kind of riot. But the numbers of detention that they're looking for, and maybe if the Big Beautiful Bill passes, there'll be, you know, larger concentration camp style facilities that are harder to escape from. But as of right now, the capacity to carry out these kinds of detentions and deportations are reaching a real limit. And that limit is proletarian self-activity, people fighting back.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fight in Newark is incredible. You know, I think, you know, these are people that are being picked up last week. They saw what's going on in LA. You know, people inside see what's going on outside, and to see that kind of dynamic interaction between militants on the outside and militants on the inside is incredible. You know, I think that there's an interesting thing about that story, which is, you know, in some sense, it's this illustration of, you know, that does the American state have the capacity to actually materially get these people, detain them and so on, and, you know, hold them in some kind of, you know, rational, kind of effective way? And it seems like no so far. But I also think, you know, historically, the process of kind of escalation towards worse and worse measures against perceived internal enemies, you know, if things aren't working and they're fucked up and, you know, the state can actually manage them, I think that can actually kind of escalate towards worse kind of outcomes, you know. You could draw analogies between, you know, the kind of early, more rational, quote unquote, steps of you know, self-deportations and then driving at the European jury in the German state. And then the kind of limits of that essentially kind of leading towards just ravaging of people directly.
I mean, the thing that popped right into my mind was Gaza, right? Is like, you've got a captive population, you've got a vulnerable population, and you also have at the same time, you said capacity, you have limited state capacity. This is something that we were talking about, like the actual limits of what's possible at this moment. Like one of the deep contradictions, of course, is that it's a structural issue that migrant labor, second tier labor, stateless labor is so essential to the American economy right now to keep things cheap. And they're not even that cheap anymore. And you have the right wing imagines that you can go back to like night watchman state. That you can do like operation, I hate to use this word, but what was it called? Operation Wetback from the 1950s, and just deport people. But it it runs up against, I think, like this castle that capital has built for itself, which is like the absolute necessity, not just in the United States, but of course in places like Israel too. You know, a lot of the people who were kidnapped on October 7th were Thai migrant laborers, right? Like migrant labor is no longer seasonal labor. And you talk about this in your article, moving back and forth across the border, but like deeply integrated into American life. And yet the big, beautiful bill, of course, is an austerity bill. It wants to like cut back on state capacity in so many different ways. Of course, put another $150 billion into enforcement, right? But like the walls, we know how incompetent the American state is these days. The walls will remain made of cheap plaster and mesh, and it will remain, you know, these basically torture chambers. Not just from intent, but also because of a lack of a budget to keep people in like sanitary conditions. The whole thing was at cross purposes with itself.
Yeah. And, you know, my real kind of pessimism or fear is that, you know, reaching those limits towards more quote unquote humane or kind of rationalized forms of detention can just lead to more directly violent, cheaper ways of dealing with this. Mm-hmm. Like which I think what we're seeing, you know, I think Gaza is a good example. You know, people are able to kind of put out this lie, but there's no genocide because, right, there's no camps, there's no kind of rational process of concentrating and extermination. But I don't think that really that's the way we see, unfortunately, or, you know, that's not really the way we see these kinds of genocidal projects carried out currently because of these limits to state capacity. You know, it's this kind of ravaging, really low-tech, slow decimation.
So I want to ask you a few more kind of specific questions about what went down in LA. But maybe this is something we could talk about behind the paywall so less people will hear it. But that's up to you.
It's up to you. I'm happy to stay on and answer more questions if get you guys paid a little bit.
Okay. Well, it's not so much getting paid. It's just, you know, it might be sensitive to talk about, but let's just have the conversation this side afterwards. In the case that this is not behind the paywall, please do support the show at patreon.com/theantifada. So that said,
for Andy and Sean.
Yeah. Two things I want to ask about. Well, I'll ask first about the Waymos, because it seems like some people in the ill will milieu are very fascinated with like new tactics that people more or less spontaneously figure out in the course of riot struggles like this. And one that seems to have a lot of residents.
Got to keep on rising. Here come Mojo rising. Here come Mojo rising. Mojo rising.
Hey, folks. Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.